first chapter of Jonah. One thing I like about television or TV or Netflix or a way to like get content in front of my eyeballs, there are a lot of things I don't like about it. One thing I do like about it is nature shows. I love, and something like I always have from a kid on, just marveling at the diversity of life on this earth. No matter which direction you go, go up to the highest peaks and the craziest places, and behold, there's life. And life doing weird stuff, you know, trying to cope with this, you know, those situations. I just enjoy that kind of variety and diversity that we find in God's earth, that kind of life. The same kind of, or at least a similar kind of diversity is among people as well, though. People are different folks. God's made all sorts of different people. They access the world slightly differently from a physical standpoint and where they're at and what they have, to their emotional lives, to their spiritual lives. We've talked a little bit about, you know, trying to put yourself in the shoes or in the mindset maybe of these mariners and their pagan roots and running into smack dab right here into Jonah and Jonah's God, and what they would think of that and how they respond to that. But this world is a place where God puts us here, each of us, and we have to make sense of what's going on around us. And people have all sorts of wonderful ideas and crazy ideas and whatever else about the world and what's going on and what we mean in it and so on. But our God, and listen to this, God hasn't left us to our own wisdom, to our own insight. Praise Him for that, because our insight is so often lacking, even though we might not think that. He has given us His Word. He has shown us who we are, what He has done in the gospel of Jesus Christ to redeem us. We've been given that light by His grace, but not everyone has been given that light. And so people have to figure out what to make of this life. They have to figure out what to make of not only the joys of this life, but of the suffering in this life and the difficulties in this life as well. It ties into even how we can see from Jonah's standpoint, from the mariner's standpoint, and finally from God's standpoint, as it were, it's human life. What's going on here? What are we to make of it? Is it cheap? Is it precious? What are we to think of human life? Let's consider Jonah first. Jonah's a curiosity all the way through the book of Jonah. Jonah's a curiosity. And that's nice on one hand because it keeps you guessing. Jonah's not cut from a particular cloth. Oh, I know how he is. We kind of know how he is in the sense that we are sinners and we often rebel against God. And we can see a lot of that in ourselves. And also the faithfulness of Jonah at other times, not necessarily here, although he does get step in and do what God says to do after a little bit of a turnaround on God's part. But Jonah is an interesting study, just himself, just how he views his life. And we get this situation here where the mariners are saying, okay, well, what do we have to do to you so that this storm will stop smashing against us? And his answer is a curiosity. Hurl me into the sea. Throw me away to my death into this tempestuous sea that's just about ready to kill all of us. Throw me into that so I don't even have the protection of the boat. Now, Jonah is a prophet. Maybe he knew. Maybe it had been revealed to him what God's going to do here. Maybe God had given him some kind of clarity or light that you need to get into that water, and that's the only way that you're going to save the lives of the men that you have put in this great risk, right? Put in this great predicament. So maybe he knew that. But the text doesn't say he knew that. And really, at every point where Jonah's talking, except chapter 2, he's not really doing the best job of being faithful. So it makes you wonder what Jonah had in mind as he asked to be tossed into the water. Was it a death wish? Was it a further means of escape? Right? Jonah's kind of on his way fleeing from the presence of Yahweh. Is this another step in that direction? Just throw me in and get it over with. Let's end this whole craziness called my life. Right? Is he suicidal? I might mention just in passing that I was brought into a very interesting and profitable, it seemed to me, avenue of ministry this week when Aaron Fugere gave me a call and said that there had been a suicide at St. Helens High School, not at the school, but one of the students. And it was the day before, and he invited me to come down and spend the day in the counseling center and just field students as they came in, and they came in. And they came in for all sorts of different reasons. They had different reasons to be there, some to skip class, others to mourn, others because they were friends with the departed, others because they were friends with friends of the departed, others because they're just trying to figure out what to make of something like that. What do you make of a 17-year-old who hangs himself? What do you do? How do you think about that? Do you have a place for that? And these high school students largely don't. They don't know how to field that. It's hard to know how to field something so with such gravitas, with some weight, with such seriousness, and such pain, thinking of the family and everyone else. That was a very profitable time for me just to sit there and try to minister, particularly with my presence, but with my words and with my questions, people that were just hurting. Because here's a person who was hurting so much, he decided that life was not the option for him, but death was. Now, there are, just even with a congregation of this size, there are probably plenty of you who have struggled with and thought through suicidal thoughts. Because life's hard, and it hurts, and pain is real. And we don't want it. We don't want that suffering. We don't want that pain. Now, I would recommend if you weren't here this morning and last week, go pick up on our website. Listen to what Brother Ed had to say about suffering, because that puts it in an entirely faithful and biblical light that we can suffer in Jesus Christ unto victory. And it still hurts. It's still painful. But in the hands of the Redeemer, that's a glorious pain. It's a pain of healing, not a pain of toward death. Well, for this particular student, he didn't have that. He didn't have that light. He didn't have that faith connecting him to Jesus Christ, the one who suffered and died for us. So he had a death wish. He wanted to escape. Was Jonah the same way? Because Jonah just said, get me out of here. I'm done with this thing. Throw me in. It's possible. The text doesn't tell us why Jonah has to be thrown. He just said, this is what you got to do. And it turns out that he was just right. That's exactly what they had to do, was throw him in. But Jonah, in looking at his willingness just to be tossed into the sea, we can at least say he seems to have a low view of human life. He's fleeing from the presence of Yahweh, and in doing so, puts the lives of the mariners with him in jeopardy. That doesn't seem to bother him quite so much as he's sleeping in the down in the midst of the boat, right? He doesn't seem to care about the problems he's causing other people. And at the end of the book, he doesn't seem to care about the Ninevites either. In fact, he says, this is the whole reason I didn't want to come, because you're going to be merciful to these Ninevites that I hate. I would rather see the Ninevites die and go to hell than actually go there and minister to people that I hate. So I think you take Jonah in his mass tonnage, he doesn't have a great deal of respect for human life. And he's the prophet of Yahweh. He's the prophet of Israel. Oh, how far we can get and think we're not. How far we can fall in our thinking and still think we're a Hebrew who fears Yahweh, who made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is. Yet our minds are twisted and perverted, and we don't see it. May God grant us clarity to see it when we're thinking unfaithfully, when we're processing this world in our lives unfaithfully, by some other standard, by some other mode of thinking, instead of what God has revealed. And that's exactly what Jonah's doing. He's got some other things going that make him not care about those mariners, that certainly, explicitly make him not care about those Ninevites. But we'll see that God is not like that as we get down to point three. So let me ask this question then. What is your view of human life? What is the biblical view of human life? If we think we're evolved pieces of monkey meat that somehow got mined along the way, however that happened, that goes a long way in setting the stage for how we're going to deal with human issues and human life and human problems. If we're nothing but evolved protoplasm, poke a hole in it. Do we care when we cut the lawn? Do we weep over the grass that we just mowed down and cut? Not a bit. And if we're just like that, who cares? Put a hole in it. It does not matter. That those ideas certainly have consequences. Now, people who think we're evolved monkey meat, they talk that way. They might think that way a little bit, but really they do not. They think of themselves as far more important than evolved nothing, from nowhere to nowhere, without meaning. They talk that way, but they don't really think that way. But even in talking that way and thinking that way partially, because everybody knows, everybody understands that there's something real going on in our lives that's important, that your life is important. Sometimes we don't extend that to the person next to us or around and say, well, there's a bunch of other people around here just like me, and their lives are important too. Now, the Bible gives us an answer for that very feeling that we have that, no, this, there's something significant. There's something meaningful. There's something important that God did, that is my life. It is your life. It is the lives of everyone around us. Because God has made us in His image. We are made in the image of God. Therein is the dignity of humanity. That's where we find true dignity for humankind and a basis for the valuing and the protection of human life. I heard some, I don't know if it was news or some show last night, I was just walking through the room and the TV was on, and somebody on the show said, it's not just, he's referring to the death of a handful of people or something like that. And he made reference to all the potential good they could have done. I bemoan that. I'm like, well, okay. What about the people themselves? What about the people themselves? Not just the good they can do for humanity or whatever other way you can kind of quantify and, you know, put it on paper and get it on a spreadsheet. What about the idea, the reality in our hearts that we are made in the image of God and are therefore important? Every single one of us, top to bottom, high to low, left to right, black to white, you name it, that we're made in the image of God. And if we are created in the image of God, then it brings things like child murder into a particular focus. We call it abortion, whitewash it, child murder, infant murder, or old folk murder, right? Elder murder, we call it euthanasia and so on, but that's what it amounts to, right? Killing off the old folks, killing off the young ones, because, man, they're really inconvenient on those sides of life. And I got stuff to do. I got a life to live. I got goals or whatever else, right? We callous ourselves, change the names of things, but we cannot follow that thinking, because God has said we are made in His image. That makes us, because God, being made in His image, it makes us important. Made in the image of God. Each of us, each one, worth taking time, not only to protect the life of, but to engage the life of. It's not enough just to protect unborn babies and then let them be raised up in ungodliness and in filth and then die in that ungodliness. It's not just protecting the physical life. Starts there, but providing for true life in Jesus Christ by ministering the gospel. Something we should be in prayer for and work for, the CPC, and that kind of ministry where it's not just ministering to the physical needs and trying to minister to the needs of these mothers and their babies, but showing them true life, giving them, if we can, the gospel of Jesus Christ Himself. This factors into how we think about capital punishment. Your view of what humanity is or what a human is factors in the capital punishment. That's a very grave scenario when we have to, as a society, take someone's life. God has commanded us to do it at certain points for the very reason that we protect human life. Because humans are made in the image of God. Therefore, if man sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. It does, however, maybe put it into a more application, in a category where we should be ready to, in the right circumstances, as God says, take human life, but make sure we have that burden of proof set just at the right place where God has it. It's very easy to get swept in for different reasons. We can be full of hatred for a person and want to see them put to death. That's not a faithful reason to support capital punishment. A faithful reason to support capital punishment is because God has said this is the way it works. By human government and by the human sword shall man's blood be shed if he sheds man's blood, because man is made in the image of God. Being made in the image of God should affect how we think about foreign policy. What countries our government makes war on. That's important. It's easy for us to dismiss it because it's on the other side of the world. Oh, and they deserve it because they did this or they did that. And we have our little justifications. And we don't feel the weight and the pain of our government killing other people around the world. We should. Every government has the same sort of set of difficulties and problems that it has to deal with. There are other countries. Some of them are antagonistic. Some of them are volatile. And we have to protect ourselves to be sure. But does not "you shall not murder" because man is made in God's image count there? Does it not count in foreign policy or in how we make war? I suggest that it does and it must as Christians. We can't just write a blank check to the government and say, hey, they have war powers and these guys over here are offensive to us. So therefore, it's okay if they die. I don't think that's faithful Christian thinking at all. So while Jonah's purposes regarding his own life really aren't clear, we don't know what's going on with that guy. We don't know why he wants to get hucked into the water. But we do see this general callousness in Jonah toward human life around him. So let me call us to repentance in that. Let us not be like that. Let us not be callous and hard toward human life around us, for God has created us in His image. And therefore we have responsibilities as humans to protect that image, to glory in that image, and to bring the gospel so that we can be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, the perfect man. That's the plan of God, as we shall see in the third point. So while Jonah's purposes are confused at best and unclear, the mariner's purposes seem quite clear. The pagan mariners seem quite clear again. They're rowing hard. They say, hey, listen, Jonah, what do we got to do? He says, toss me in the water. They say, okay, we're going to keep rowing. We're going to try and get this thing figured out. Because why? What's their concern? It's right there in the text. It actually says their concern in the text. It's in verse 14. It says, therefore they called out to Yahweh, O Yahweh, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood. Okay, this is this man here, and by his own testimony, he says he's running from your face. He's got us all in this predicament. But they're loath, they're slow to murder this man, to throw him into the water, to kill, because to throw him into the water is as good as dead. And they might as well put a bullet through his head as throw him in the water. They're throwing him out there to his death. They don't want to do it. Jonah doesn't seem to mind that he's put them in harm's way and death's door, but they sure mind. The fact that they're willing to themselves work harder and give of themselves so as not to throw Jonah into the water. So it's not just like there's a mental reservation. I don't like the idea of whacking one of Yahweh's prophets. That doesn't sound like a real, like, you know, advantageous position to be put in, though there maybe is that going on as well. They don't want innocent blood on their hands because they know to murder a man is ungodly. They know it. It's right there. And they don't want to do it, and they're trying whatever they can do, from throwing out their own livelihood to rowing hard to get to dry land, all their own effort to try to avoid that sin, to try to avoid that infraction before God. They even pray to Yahweh before they do it. Right? They say, listen, you're doing this thing. It's like they almost trust in providence, right? They believe Yahweh really has thrown this storm at them and that it's His doing and that they've done everything they can to try to save this man's life. But this very prophet of God himself says, you got to throw me in. I'm the problem. You got to throw me in. And so they try to avoid it, but at the end of the hour, they can't. They cannot avoid what Jonah says to do. And so they throw him in. So insofar as they were able, rowing, questioning, praying, insofar as they were able to preserve human life, they tried. Remember, these are the pagan mariners. This isn't the prophet of Yahweh who knows that man is made in God's image because he's read the scripture. He's taught the scripture. These are pagans that don't know this by special revelation. They know it by natural revelation. God has written it on their hearts. You shall not murder. Again, our opposition to death, say in the political realm of abortion and euthanasia and so on, isn't just opposition to the evil, but it's active participation toward the good, active work toward life. It's not just opposing the murder of infants or the murder of the elderly. It's actively giving of ourselves to remedy that, to fight for life and against death. And we see that even in these pagans, we see that natural bent toward fighting for, rowing hard, trying hard to avoid this wickedness before God. We are called to live self-sacrificially toward life like these pagan mariners. So Jonah's purposes are not clear with regard to human life. Can't really tell. Seems callous. The mariner's purposes are quite clear. They value human life and don't want to be charged by God for unrighteously taking human life. That's what the idea of innocent life is here, is unconvicted life. Right? There's no conviction that would cause them to say, this guy is worthy of death. Like Paul says, hey, if I've done anything worthy of death, I'm not opposed to dying. As Paul says, if I've committed a capital offense, there should be a capital punishment. Same thing going on here, but there has been no capital offense, and there is, therefore, should be no capital punishment. But providence has put them in this tight spot. But it is to that providence that we now turn to see the real purposes of God in this strange hodgepodge of an unfaithful prophet, living unfaithfully, acting unfaithfully, speaking semi-faithfully, and yet these mariners, these pagans, seeming like they're, by God's mercy, being drawn into faithfulness through the ministry of an unfaithful prophet. Yahweh's purposes, at least relative to the mariners, this is the last we see of them, right? They're gone from the story after we get past chapter 1, seems to be to draw them near, to bring light to them through this erring and sinful prophet. Jonah puts them again into an impossible position. It's Jonah's doing that has ruined their lives. It's Jonah's doing, it's the believer's doing that has put these unbelievers in an impossible spot where they've lost their livelihood, they're bound to lose their lives, and now they got to throw this guy off into the ocean and deal with the wrath of Yahweh, his God, because they're throwing a prophet of Yahweh into the water to his death. So he's put them into an impossible position. Yet God, through Jonah's very unfaithful ministry, through Jonah's faithful, unfaithful ministry, that very ministry is what I mean, left the mariners in a warm spot. And, impossibly, they get left with a calm sea, fear and praise to Yahweh, and offering sacrifices to Him and making vows. It leaves them in a very good place. It leaves them almost as God-fearers. Those who trust Yahweh, who trust His covenants, who believe the promises, but who are estranged from being Jews. They're not Jews after the flesh, and they haven't been circumcised, but they're like God-fearers that we see so often in the book of Acts, kind of hovering around the worship of God, hovering around the people of God. God has taken these mariners who it seemed knew nothing about Him and has brought them near through the errant and sinful ministry of one of His prophets. Here's the light that we see, salvation for the Gentiles. Salvation even for these mariners that Jonah put in this impossible position. We see the same intent, I think. We see that divine intent for the mariners. But we also see, if we kind of look at the whole book, God's intent for the salvation even of Nineveh. He didn't say, by the way, about Nineveh, God didn't say to Jonah, oh, by the way, Nineveh's cried out to me and they're seeking salvation. I want you to go there and give them the good news. Not a bit. It's their wickedness. He wants Jonah to go cry out against their wickedness. He wants them to go tell them why they're doing it wrong. You think a prophet that doesn't like those people would be happy to do that. With one exception. He knows how God is. He knows how God is. And that gets in his craw. That becomes a problem for him. Look over at chapter 4. So after God relented from the disaster He had promised upon Nineveh, through the preaching of Jonah, we come to chapter 4. Jonah is displeased because God had relented. He hadn't brought that judgment upon Nineveh. It says it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to Yahweh and said, oh, Yahweh, is this not what I said when I was in my country? This is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and relenting from disaster. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. Right, so he's still in the same spot. He's still fleeing from Yahweh's face. He still doesn't want Yahweh to be merciful to his enemies. He'd rather see his enemies perish than see the salvation of God come to them, and particularly by his own hand. He's so angry that he wants to die. God says, do you do well to be so angry? Do you, Jonah, do well to be so angry? Let me pause and ask this. Are there people in your life that you would rather just see die and go to hell? My guess is there are. My guess is there are. People that at the end of the day you really kind of despise, you really kind of hate, and you might not even go out of your way to like help them, give them a hand, let alone go out of your way to give them the pearl of great price, that they should be saved, that they should be redeemed. Sometimes that can come through people that have hurt us, people that have damaged us. You can imagine a situation where, you know, a person really damages a family, murders someone in the family, where the family could hate that person, want them dead, have a death wish for that person. That's kind of like Jonah. That's the prophet Jonah. As it comes to his ministry, where God forces him finally to get to Nineveh and preach, and in his preaching, he shows himself merciful. In Jonah's preaching, God shows himself merciful, and Jonah's mad, because he knew that was going to happen. I knew it from the beginning. That's why I went the other direction. I didn't want you to be merciful to these people, so I wanted to keep my mouth shut and just take my mouth the other direction so that you couldn't operate through me. Do you have such hardness of heart? I suspect in a lot of ways we do. In a lot of ways we do. People of God, pray that God would give you soft hearts. Soft hearts toward your enemies. Toward the people who you have every justification in your mind not to like, not to minister to. And we can talk about demographics of people that evangelicals just tend to hate. We'd rather not minister to homosexuals. We'd rather not minister to inner city folks. They're icky down there. They do icky stuff. And we're white collar folks over here. We don't deal with that. There are a thousand reasons why we would separate ourselves from the ministry that God would have in front of us. The very people right around us. The very people in our community that are hurting. And just as the example of the school, that high school. How many of us have written off public high schools? That's where Satan is. That's Satan's ground. Why are we homeschool? This is God's country over here. That's Satan's over there. But it's not. It's not Satan's. You know why? Because Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And he says, I'll have all of it. Every piece of it is mine. Now go and take my message to all of those people out there. Now, this that you hate, that you don't want, that you don't like, that you don't mix with, that don't fit into your, like, your demographic, your financial, your economic style. Get past all those divisions and say, these are people made in the image of God who are perishing. And we, like Jonah, often run the other direction. We got better stuff to do. But we don't. People of God, we don't. We are called on this earth to a mission. The mission of the church, go disciple the nations. The nations? Those Gentiles? Yes, the nations. This should remind you of the book of Acts. This is the church's growing pain right from the beginning. How do we deal with the people we don't like? With the people we don't want in our midst? When God says, go get them and bring them in. Shake the bushes, the highways, the hedges. Bring the nasty ones in, the ones you don't like. And I'll give them a robe. I'll give them righteousness. And hasn't people of God listened carefully? Hasn't he done that for you? Aren't you a reject? Aren't you one that people should probably run and plug their ears and run away from? Or are you just so upright and okay, everyone should kind of like you? Not for a second. We trick ourselves. We think much of ourselves. We think very little of others. We're following Jonah in that regard. God, however, does not do that. He says this at the end of chapter 4. So, remember, he makes the plant and grows up, and Jonah's happy, and then he kills the plant, and Jonah's angry again right there in chapter 4. And so God says this to him, and Yahweh said, you pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came up into being in one night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, that great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not even know their right hand from their left, and much cattle? You pity this little comfort. You pity this plant that was just a little bit of comfort for your head. Yet you do not pity this great city full of people that are ignorant, that don't know the salvation of God. We get everything out of whack. But we can. Here's the crazy thing. We can stand in the middle of that and think it's not out of whack. Think we got it straight. Think we're doing okay. We're pretty good Christians. We're doing this and that, right? But we're out of whack. We don't have God's priorities as our priorities. We substituted other priorities from other parts of life and other things that we're interested in. instead of God's priorities. And God's priorities are these: the salvation of the world. That's the priority of God. God wants to remake His image. He made Adam and Eve in His image. In their sin, they besmirched, they perverted that image. So God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, the express image of God, it says, to conform us through the life and death of Jesus Christ to that image again. God is committed to people. God is committed to the ungodly. He's committed to His enemies to make them His friends, to make them godly, to bring them in. God is committed that way. Should not we be? Should that not be the centerpiece of our heart as Christians? We are on mission. You're on a mission with your wife, husbands. You're on a mission with your husbands, wives. You're on a mission with your friends, friends. You're on a mission. This colors every part of our lives. God has called us to be the means of salvation to those around us, within our families, within the church, and to the world. God has called us to this kind of faithfulness because He values human life to the extent where He would send His own Son to become one of us, to suffer for us. We who deserve the suffering, that's one thing. Jesus Christ deserved no sort of suffering. Yet He comes and He takes on human flesh. He suffers and dies for the ungodly. There is the mission. There is the heart of God caring for humanity, caring for the people that He has made, committed to redeeming them and bringing that fullness of the image of God into fruition through Jesus Christ and His redemption. So people of God, let us be excited about that in our own lives and as a ministry to others, particularly those we'd rather not minister to. So don't let the moment pass by. Write down some of those people that you'd rather not minister to, that you'd rather not rub shoulders with, or that at the end of the day, if you're honest, you just hate. Your heart's hard toward them. And pray that God would open your heart and make you a minister of the unspeakable mercies of God and Jesus Christ, who reconciles enemies with Himself, who gives His Son for dead, wicked sinners, that He should make them His family. He should share His riches with them. Oh, we've been given so much. To whom much is given, much is required. Amen.